given night or day. You can find the Power and Light Entertainment District or the 18th and Vine Jazz District strangely empty. It brings to mind the enduring thoughts of Jane Jacobs, author of the seminal volume on urban development and decline, titled The Death and Life of Great American Cities. She said cities have the capability of providing something for everybody, only because and only when they are created for everybody. She also says you can't rely on bringing people downtown. You have to put them there. Today, we welcome you live from downtown Kansas City with a discussion on city building, one block at a time. This is the first of a two-part series for Central Standard, which begins today with KCUR's team coverage of a discussion about the new American city. Join us on Central Standard and also on Up to Date. We're live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts after this hour's NPR News. Good morning, Kansas City. Within eyeshot, beyond these white pillars, a Sheraton used to be a Hyatt. There's the Western Auto Building, anchoring downtown at the KC Center for the Performing Arts, the Kauffman Center. Behind us is history. In front of us is potential. Ahead of us is hard work. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. You join us live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. One block at a time, why neighborhood renewal works is the subject of today's discussion. Our guests are Simon O'Byrne, Vice President of Urban Planning for Stantec, and Tim Dugan, Senior Landscape Architect for the Make It Right Foundation. He's done some work down in New Orleans. Gentlemen, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now tell us, there's a lot of breakout sessions here, and tell us what you've learned so far and why you came to this conference.
Why I came to this conference was to learn more about some of the best practices happening in terms of cities, hear the different ideas that are going on, everything from urban planning to how do we create more dynamic cities, how do we revitalize our downtowns, how do we get more investment happening in our cities, how do we kind of get back to where we were in terms of our downtowns. It's been a big focus on our mature areas and making them vibrant. And a lot of stories come back to that, whether it's dealing with education, whether it's dealing with taxation, whether it's dealing with perceptions of crime and safety, whether it's about attracting investment. Because I think there's an attitude and a realization today that as go our core cities, as go our regions. So if our cores are not vibrant and successful, then the regions are not going to be vibrant and successful. They're not going to be able to attract and retain labor, and they're not going to be a destination of choice for people to travel to, live to, and so forth. So we need to have strong, vibrant cores, and I think everyone gets that message. There's a lot of mayors here today, and they're all talking about the same thing. How do we make our cores vibrant and healthy?
Tim Dugan, you were part of the breakout session yesterday titled One Block at a Time, Why Neighborhood Renewal Works. What was discussed at that session, and what did you get out of it?
Well, so many of our urban cores have been in decline for so many years, and as we, as a culture, move back to the cities, we want to be invigorated in a live, work, play mentality and see economic development and sustainable development transformation firsthand. Well, I've been working down in New Orleans, and we didn't suffer economic disasters like many of the urban cores around the country. We've suffered a significant natural disaster that started with a disaster but led to an opportunity. If we're going to redo and rethink these urban cores in these cities, how can we do it in a sustainable and a regenerative manner? How can we invite economic development, and how can we bring a big idea and a catalyst back into these cities as we rebuild them? And that's firsthand what I've been experiencing down in New Orleans and beyond.
Yet it's important to note that at some point, the economic disaster and natural disaster come into parity in terms of neighborhood blight. Can you talk about that?
Well, neighborhood blight is, there's many, many issues around that suffer. You know, we can talk about this in many debates, but what we truly find is that there's been a lack of resources, a lack of attention, and a lack of funding mechanisms to create a truly sustainable community. When you have infrastructure that is falling on the wayside, an educational system that is neglected, and very minimal economic development opportunities, then bad things occur. When you turn that on its head and focus strategically, you can create these urban interventions, if you will. Bob Birkenbaum used yesterday the term urban acupuncture. It's very different than these scattered sites approaches that our municipalities and urban cores have taken in history.
At the point of a needle, in other words.
Absolutely.
Simon O'Byrne, he talked about a debate. Let's open up the debate by actually defining urban renewal and the debates around buzzwords.
There's a lot of baggage with the term urban renewal, and a lot of you look at planners really got it wrong, to be honest, in the 50s and 60s, and I think the 70s and 80s were apologetic for getting it so wrong in the 50s and 60s.
Kind of Robert Moses's idea of that top-down New York.
That top-down kind of educated professional knows best, and not empowering locals, and disempowering grassroots, and assuming that top-down approach is the model to go by. We got it wrong, and now planning is, the pendulum swung quite a bit the other way, the Jane Jacobs approach. But the Jane Jacobs approach can also can swing a little bit too far that way. And so what we need to have is a little bit more of a balanced model, because sometimes we become too fearful of trying to do bigger projects as well and taking on some of our bigger challenges.
Simon O'Byrne, for those who aren't familiar with Robert Moses or Jane Jacobs, who are both on the opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of sprawl and in terms of being local urbanists respectively, talk about the differences in their philosophies, and we can bring in Tim Dugan as well.
So Robert Moses was in charge, he was the parks commissioner for New York, and assumed a huge amount of power. And if you look at the amount of infrastructure that was built in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in New York, all roads led to Moses. And he basically, the major bridges, the major infrastructure, the major parks, all of that, he assumed gradually and incrementally more and more power and control. And there was a lot of racism in what he did in terms of deliberately preventing city buses from going to certain areas, building big interstates that would cut right through poor neighborhoods that were disproportionately African-American and other groups that were disproportionately marginalized. And so he did that in the sense that it was city building. It was about building towards the future. It was almost trying to create, you think of Fritz Lang's Metropolis. And I think he had those kind of images in mind of creating this grand metropolis. And at the other end of the spectrum, we have Jane Jacobs. And Jane Jacobs was more realizing that that's not how we create vibrant places that we love. The places that we love are the places that constitute messy vibrancy. They're organic. They're healthy. They're the local butcher where you're buying your food from. There's lots of kids on the street hanging out. And it's vibrant. And her attitude was, let's get away from the major projects and instead focus in more of a bit of this block by block. Let's kind of get that right on a much smaller scale. So let's do it more ground up as opposed to the top down.
Tim Dugan, you're a landscape architect. I can see that parity in this comparison with Power and Light, which is just north of us, the Power and Light Entertainment District, and the Crossroads Arts District, which is just south of us, below where we're sitting right now. On one hand, you have an organic growth based on artistic movement. On the other hand, you have a planned development. And these are sort of the opposing ideas that we were just talking about. Talk about these opposing ideas in terms of urban renewal one block at a time.
Well, I think being down in New Orleans for the last 4 or 5 years, I'll give an analogy that our urban planning needs to be a little bit more like gumbo, a little bit less of either or, because both are needed in some facet. But when you polarize the situation and make a decision between the two, you see that lines are drawn and major concerns of gentrification and of just pushing aside the existing community and the social fabric of the neighborhood. And that's so far from what the successful plans and approaches are that we have all been encountered down in New Orleans. It's been such a community-based and community-driven approach, letters of invitation into these projects from the neighborhood, and they then firsthand see the successes because they have ownership of the project, much like the developers have ownership of the project.
What does this gumbo between macro and micro development look like?
Well, it's a messy process, and collaboration is never an easy situation. But what we found in the different communities we've worked in when you extend the letter of invitation and receive that from a neighborhood, when you involve them in a transparent and honest conversation about how they want their neighborhood to evolve, you provide inputs from the economic development side, you begin to create both a catalyst and something that is sustainable. And that's what I think is the unique situation that we have here in Kansas City.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. We're live on location from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts in the heart of downtown Kansas City, discussing the heart of urban planning at the conference, The New American City, an ongoing conversation that's happening this week and part of a two-part series here on Central Standard, where we examine what the new American city looks like through the eyes of several planners. And, of course, through your eyes, Kansas City. We are not taking calls at this point, but we do welcome comments via social media on Facebook and on Twitter, where our handle is at KCURCST. Chime in on your thoughts on urban renewal and urban development. We're talking to the panelists of a discussion that recently took place, Why Neighborhood Renewal Works One Block at a Time. Now, we talked about these opposing views, almost evangelistic in tone, almost gospels of development, the top-down versus the local neighborhood block-by-block development. What do you think, Simon, about one block at a time? Is piecemealing better than city planners and leaders having a broader vision?
I think piecemealing is great in the sense that what you think you really almost need to do a bit of both. So I think urban planners, what they need to do is change how we've been doing planning so far. A lot of planning today is land use planning, which is really a legacy of public health. The only reason we even have planning to begin with was we used to put foundries beside residential areas, and there's public health issues that occurred, and so we had to segregate land uses for public health reasons. As that transposed over the years, it developed and became more and more regulatory. The trouble today is our economy's changed, and it's changed substantially. Demographics and the economy shifted, and we need our planning to change in response to what's occurred. What we need to be doing today is regulating the right things, not the wrong things. What we're regulating now are things like land uses and heights and things like that and parking. What we should be focused on a little bit more is the design. So how do we get much better quality design? How do we get much more interesting and dynamic public realms? And how do we do that? And with that, we need to get, there's language the planners use called form-based code and things like that that get more focused on design and opposed to land uses. But what we really need is to revisit how we're doing planning to basically set the stage and get the ingredients right and say, going forward, these are the kind of designs we want, these are the kinds of principles, and then kind of get out of the way and then let small-scale entrepreneurs and let the community and let individuals take a lot more ownership as their neighborhoods revitalize block by block, house by house, building by building, and to let that occur.
Our guests, by the way, are Tim Dugan, a senior landscape architect with the Make It Right Foundation. He's done work down in New Orleans and done some local work here in Kansas City as well. Simon O'Byrne is the vice president of urban planning for a Canadian-based company, Stantec, which has substantial operations here in North America. Let's talk a little bit right now, beginning with Tim and then back to you, Simon, about what each of you do within the aspects of urban planning.
Well, my role with the Make It Right Foundation was to develop a few different programs. One was to develop the Community Beyond Housing program for Make It Right. We were invited into the neighborhood about 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, and very clearly were we told by the neighborhood that we want you to focus on building houses and bringing people home. We don't want someone to come in and do a master plan for our neighborhood. We don't want to have a giant developer come in and lead us down the pathway towards sustainability. We want to get our friends and family home, and we will see how we go from there. And so our organization was founded under that premise, but it was more importantly to figure out the paradigm between sustainability and affordability. People should be able to live in a healthy, safe city, a healthy, safe house. They should be surrounded by environments that don't cause them cancer or give them asthma. And that was the core idea about this. How do we propagate sustainable development to the masses? We saw this disaster in New Orleans as an opportunity. We saw this as a way to rebuild community, rebuild infrastructure. and rebuild city systems that don't look to replicate the last 50 years, but look towards a regenerative solution for the next 100 years. And that idea gained weight. We now just broke ground on our 100th LEED Platinum house. In 4 years' time, we've gone to the greenest neighborhood in the country. And we've taken this to other cities around the country as well to sustain the life of our work in New Orleans.
Did that idea gain weight also because of the etouffee and the beignets that you have down there in New Orleans, that good food?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Simon O'Byrne, you've advocated this inside-out approach to urban planning in terms of the larger metropolitan area. What types of work have you done over at Stantec, and give us a sense of what it is. Is it consultancy? Is it full range services for development in urban environments? What is it?
All of that. We do, myself, as I'm an urban planner, but I work with people that do professional public consultation, civil engineers, landscape architects, people that do environmental reclamation of former gas stations and turning them into housing and so forth. So we're a firm of over 13,000 in North America that does all aspects of urban development, and from greenfield to the most urban environments and transit and so forth. Myself, I focus on everything from working on downtown plans and working with cities on how we revitalize them. I work with developers or municipalities on doing transit-oriented development, work on the public realm and how do we create. One of the reasons I got into planning in the beginning was I wanted to be in the business of great placemaking, and that's been an underlying thing that I've tried to do in my career, and that's what I tried to do in terms of creating a vibrant public realm and trying to create beautiful cities.
Any remembrances or any things to offer in terms of urban renewal projects that just didn't work that you've either been involved in or heard about? And success stories as well.
I'd like to talk maybe about the more successes, but some of the failures of urban planning, going back to Robert Moses, and I had the benefit of going to the Pratt Institute for grad school in Brooklyn and seeing the damage that was caused by Robert Moses in ramrodding through the Cross Bronx Expressway.
Brooklyn Queens Expressway.
Exactly. Right. I used to work on a project in Hunts Point in the South Bronx, and I saw the devastation that occurred in that neighborhood through the Cross Bronx Expressway. And that neighborhood, I did research on Hunts Point, and there were Jimmy Carter and Reagan and others, presidents had come through and said, Berlin in 1945 didn't even look as bad as Hunts Point did. And so the devastation that occurred as a consequence of ramrodding through those projects. So real severe devastation. And so juxtaposed with that, though, there's so many good things happening right now. And a lot of it's driven by demographics and a change of people. There's a lot of people today, depending on the city, where as much as a quarter to a fifth of the Gen Y population doesn't even have driver's license now. Whereas when I was 16, my 16th birthday, I rushed out and I got a driver's license. Today, I was speaking at a college a couple of weeks ago, and I asked everyone to put up their hand who here didn't have a driver's license. And a fifth, and they were about 2021, did not have driver's license, not even, which is a big transformation. So you start thinking about that and what that means to our cities, that there's this gigantic cohort coming that really get it in terms of cities. They want it. They crave that high degree of social interaction that can only come from living in a very urban environment versus a suburban environment.
I want to get back to this idea of the Berlin Wall. My predecessor here and sort of spiritual mentor in the talk show circuit, as it were, Wal Bodin, once described Troost Avenue as Kansas City's version of the Berlin Wall in communist era Germany, talking about the divide between East and West Germany. And here it's a divide culturally and class-based between East and West Kansas City. Rachel Jane on Facebook, for instance, says Troost and East of Troost contain neighborhoods that are economic, educational, and food deserts. One-on-one mentoring for parents, business owners, and children would be a good start. Economic programs to create empowerment and jobs for the people who live there, and school systems that inspire and promise a quality education starting on a level that they need to be addressed. that makes sense for the people who live there. Local grocery stores, possibly via urban farming, to provide quality meats, fruits, and vegetables, proper nutrition for people who lack the resources of transportation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You hear this all the time. And Tim, you're working on a project at 43rd and Troost.
Yeah, I have quite a bit of history in Troost. I was one of the initial folks that that helped kickstart with some great souls the Tulips on Troost program, which was the idea to break down those barriers and change the perception of color with a tulip. And it was very successful. I believe there's over 2 million tulips planted on that corridor in the last few years. But our organization looked towards projects beyond New Orleans, we were attracted to the opportunity along the Troost Corridor, and specifically that in the Green Impact Zone. And about a year ago, we engaged the Manheim Park Neighborhood Association and the Green Impact Zone to create an idea for a catalytic project around the Bancroft School. It was a school that had been boarded up for close to 15 years.
Catalytic converter.
Absolutely.
So to speak.
Absolutely. And we right now are under construction on 50 units of LEED Platinum construction with a historical school renovation, community gardens, stormwater management showcase, and Truman Medical Center is operating a mobile medical clinic out of the common spaces in the school that historically were gymnasiums and auditoriums. And this kind of a regenerative catalyst is very exciting because it's once awarded, it leveraged in excess of $100 million of federal and state funding coming to the Troost Corridor and the surrounding region.
One of the purposes of this discussion is to sort of get out of the buzzwords and industry jargon and into the practical examples. Can you back up and explain this LEED certification in terms of the ecological certification, the LEED Platinum certification? What does that mean?
Well, there's
it's not about rap albums selling a million albums.
No,
right?
The U.S. Green Building Council is a third-party organization system started several years ago to rate the level of how green your building is.
Right.
And there's debates on that we can have on a future show. But the rating systems start at the certified level, and at the highest level is platinum. So we're achieving the highest level of environmental design on this project. We're having 1,300 square foot living units with $22 a month utility bills. We're putting 75 kilowatts of solar array on the roof. We're restoring an abandoned elementary school and putting very high efficiency systems and tight building envelopes back into this project.
Real quickly, what does that area in Manheim at Troost and 43rd look like after this project is finished?
Well, we coincidentally are the first project in the Manheim Park neighborhood, and we see several folks that are really aligning with that vision and are coming to the table to focus on the mixed-use development aspects of Troost, to focus on weatherization, rehab, and reconstruction of infill housing, of elevating the existing housing stock. And we're very excited about what can happen. Hopefully the Manheim Park will be the greenest neighborhood in the country in the next few years. And that's with the platform of Make It Right and frankly, our founder, Brad Pitt, we have a very unique opportunity to collaborate and to share the crayons, if you will, with a lot of different folks that historically wouldn't play together.
We are live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts in Kansas City, Missouri, downtown Kansas City, Missouri. Our guests are Tim Dugan, Senior Landscape Architect with the Make It Right Foundation, and Simon O'Byrne, Vice President of Urban Planning for Stantec. We've been discussing city building one block at a time, part of the breakout sessions here, Why Neighborhood Renewal Works at the New American City. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more discussion about urban renewal and urban planning. We'd like to hear from you, Kansas City, on Facebook and Twitter as well, where our handle is at KCURCST. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. We're live from what locals call the Kauffman, but it's the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, looking at the architecture right now of Midtown Kansas City to my south, the historic Western Auto Building, and a nice placement of green space over there at Liberty Memorial and Penn Valley Park. And we also have in the southwest corner near Southwest Boulevard in the distance a moat-like freeway, I-35, taking people mostly out of town. And as you look out these windows right now from the Kauffman, south, north, or east or west, there are almost no pedestrians at this hour. And we continue our discussion on urban renewal one block at a time, how neighborhood renewal works and how it doesn't work, with our guest, Tim Dugan, a senior landscape architect for Make It Right Foundation, and Simon O'Byrne, vice president for urban planning for Stantec, a Canadian company with substantial operations here in North America. Let's talk about this concept, revisit this concept of one block at a time. And I'm going to put a challenge out there. If you do one block at a time, if you have one block that has a new development of townhomes and an urban garden, so to speak, and on the next block is a hot corner where the boys are pumping crack, how does that work? How does one block at a time work?
Well, when you have one block at a time, it does send a message. I think everyone wants the silver bullet that's going to fix it all at one big go. And as we talked about earlier on in the program, that doesn't work. It very rarely has it worked. What we need to do is much smaller scale, incremental development and renewal. We got to get it down to a much smaller scale, allow small scale entrepreneurs to do what they want to do in terms of redevelopment, whether it's opening up a new coffee shop, whether it's about building new townhomes, whether it's about opening up an artist work live type of space. But we need to create those opportunities. The trouble is, how do you really, in those situations where you've got crime and you've got urban renewal, and how do you find that balance? How do you deal with some of the issues of gentrification, which is obviously a massive issue? How do you also still get more of that development? Because you might have one developer buys up half a block and does townhomes, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to spur someone to do the next type of thing. You have to find that balance between, into what Tim's been talking about in terms of collaboration between all the different parties. So I like to think of urban planners as the dinner host at a potluck dinner, where you're the facilitator and organizer of this event, and get everyone in the same room, and you facilitate that discussion between the municipality, the police department, the school boards, the developers, the community organizations, the NGOs, and get everyone in the same room talking about how do we do this type of thing. And too often, it's not a full inclusionary process.
And Tim Dugan, how do you address that with these sort of islands of development amid the blight? Blight over here, blight over here, literally within the same block sometimes.
Well, too often, historically, we have taken a scattered sites approach and looked at one block with a little bit of randomness to it. And we found that it's very successful in terms of one block at a time if you pick the right block. And picking the right block means the starting point, the first block, needs to be adjacent to public transportation. It needs to be adjacent to mixed-use zoning opportunities for small business economic development. It needs to have a housing stock that can be rehabbed and upgraded, a neighborhood that can provide infill opportunities. It needs to have a nucleus. Otherwise, the one block won't be sustainable. Otherwise, the one block will become blight, and you replace it with blight. And that's not the right approach. But when you strategically overlay a series of layers of needed amenities, you can then begin to start the nucleus that one block can turn into three blocks, that can turn into 10 blocks, that are all founded and anchored in very strong urban planning principles.
You're talking about, Simon. Yep. Not to interrupt you, sorry about that. This is what you're talking about with this sort of organic growth process.
It's really taking a cumulative effects approach. So it's the aggregate of all these small little things adding up to something much bigger. One of the things that we talk about in one of the examples cited yesterday is there's these big demographic shifts that are occurring, and I talked about yesterday. David Brooks, in his column 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, had a couple stats I thought were really interesting. In 1950, 9% of households were single. Today, it's a third. In some European countries, it's more than 40% of households are single. We're trending more and more that way. The other stat in there was there are now more dogs than children. So I made the rather cheeky comment yesterday that dogs are the new kids. And one of the things that's happening, because our single population or double income, no kid population is increasing so quickly, a lot of people are having more and more choosing to want to have dogs and so forth. But one of the things I like to talk about is we can talk about the things that fix the supply part of new housing, new investment, creating the right ingredients for it. But the other part is the demand side. How do we get people to want to choose to live in more urban environments and do that trade-off between the suburbs and between the urban, and what are the ingredients they're looking for? And one of the big things, for example, it's a small thing, but it's a big thing, that if there are now more dogs and children, which is a reality, then what we need to do is put in a lot more dog parks and a lot more bags for the pooping, scooping, and that kind of thing. And here's why. Because if two people walk down the sidewalk and neither of them has a dog, they barely acknowledge one another. They walk down the street and one of them has a dog, there might be some interaction with the dog. Two people walk down the street, both have dogs, they're going to start to interact. The 12th time that they've seen each other walking down the sidewalk with the dogs, they know the dog's name, they know a little bit about their story, that interaction starts, and it helps that community building because there's the high degree of social interaction. And that's really what you want to do, is do ingredients that are going to foster a higher degree of social interaction.
Well, I don't know if you can see the scoop bag from here, but if you look out this large window here, we have a dog park right here in Penn Valley Park, which is a straight shot out here south. But talk about this idea of sprawl. Is sprawl killing our cities? We talked about the Johnson County versus urban core example that you hear all the time. As an outsider from Edmonton, Alberta, and an outside consultant on a lot of these projects, how do you feel about that juxtaposition?
Well, there's sprawl is a loaded term, and there's the most egregious kind of sprawl, which is the country residential stuff that's very low in density, and then there's that which is in a higher density. So it depends, and it's different across the continent. There are some cities that are getting density levels of 50 units to the acre in brand new suburban areas because of regulations and so forth, and high land costs. You know, that would be the case if you were to go to Boston, let's just say. Whereas in KC here in Johnson County, you're a lot of the new development or acreage development, which is consuming a huge amount of farmland. And it's not transit supportive at all. It's not integrated in terms of including opportunities for shopping and living and working and playing within the same jurisdiction and environment. So the trouble is, how do you achieve that right kind of balance? I believe that, you know, there's been a big slowdown, obviously, in suburban development, and there's been a big shift back in terms of emphasis on the urban areas. High gas prices are going to drive that. But I think one of the biggest issues that's the elephant in the room here with suburban development is we are not going to slow down suburban development. We're not going to fully fix our urban environments till in this country we properly deal with public schools. And so public schools need to be dealt with, and the region has to realize, getting back to my earlier point, is so goes your urban center, so goes your region, that if we don't fix our public schools in our mature neighborhoods and cities, then it's going to undermine the entire region.
And in Kansas City, that's the third rail red button issue that keeps going on and on again. And hate to go back to what Walt Bodine says, but Walt Bodine essentially says people will do everything about their public schools except vote. So that's an interesting thing to invoke what Walt Bodine says about the public education system. You're actually working on a school, Tim Dugan, in an old school in an area on 43rd and Truce. Tell us about what you've seen in terms of that blight, in terms of that hole, in terms of that hot button issue.
Well, we're actually working on a school that there's so many abandoned schools in our urban core that we need to find an adaptive reuse for those. I mean, the neighborhood school in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was the core nucleus of the neighborhood. It was the safe destination. It's where everyone walked to school. Now kids in Kansas City, Missouri School District are on the bus for 2 to 3 hours a day, and you see this building that was the nucleus is now the cancer. And so what we have tried to do is find different funding mechanisms that can breathe life back into that school and provide a platform for safe resources, education, and health awareness and also apply a housing filter on top of that, because those are the only mechanisms that we have found to fund that kind of renaissance. There are no incentives or tax credits around to fix a school, and that's a shame. And so our organization realizes that the Bancroft should be a school, but in lieu that it cannot, we feel that this is another adaptive repurpose that's a very sustainable one.
Simon O'Byrne, you come from sort of what's called, even using the voice, magical kingdom of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, where there's universal health care and where a lot of the affluent people's kids go to school with working class and even poor people's kids because of this sort of streamlined congruency in the educational system there. Talk about that.
It's
magical kingdom.
I think it's a very unique place. It's a city of over a million people where there's basically no private schools. So the majority of the population, overwhelmingly, 99% of the population goes to public schools. So those with the most privilege in society that come from very wealthy, affluent backgrounds go to the same schools as those that are in public housing. And so the result is a much more egalitarian model, but also raises the bar. And it's a school district that prides itself on also catering to all kinds of different needs. So there's not just the normal kind of magnet schools and so forth, but each school has got a different pedagogy. So there might be a Waldorf model that's fully public. It might be something that focuses more on the, you know, back to basics, math and science, and something that might even be a hockey academy or ballet incorporated into it, but that each school is constantly reinventing itself. And there's actually a competition between the schools as opposed to the school districts. So it makes principals much more empowered to compete with one another in terms of the pedagogy of that school, in terms of the focus of this. Is it more sports? Is it more academics? And as you go through neighborhood life cycles, where the school-age population moves out, and changes, the schools constantly have to reinvent themselves between the peaks and valleys when the school age population declines. And so one of the things that happens in Edmonton with the school district is allowing this competition, allowing schools to reinvent themselves constantly, and then also realize that the schools are critical to the neighborhoods. And this is where the interface between land use planning and schools come into place, because if the schools close and they fail, then that neighborhood is doomed. You're never going to get young families to move back into that community again once you get a school closure. So one of the things that we're talking about is in those valleys when the school-age population declines, which always happens with every neighborhood, what we need to do is reinvent those schools. So include daycares in them, senior centers, art centers, and not for the whole school, but for maybe a wing of the school and things like that, and basically turn them into multi-purpose, multifaceted community centers where education is a component but not the exclusive use and activity. It's a way to kind of bridge that gap between the big peaks of the school-age population.
And as we sit in a literal ivory tower, it seems like a glass case has been put over the Guggenheim Museum in here. Very expansive, very ambitious, very world-renowned, internationally respected Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts in the heart of downtown Kansas City. You can literally see the view of the disparities here in terms of the development and the patches of land and the patches of neighborhoods and the haves and have-nots. And that's not an easy prescription. But, Tim, talk about how education moves forward that block-by-block process. He just did. Chime in. You're shaking your head, man.
Well, that's not just a buzzword. It's what makes our communities sustainable, and it makes our communities competitive, and it makes them be able to move forward in a manner that creates community. Otherwise, we create a sense of blight, a sense of distrust, a sense of the opposite of neighborhood, and from that, nothing happens in a positive manner. And so until we can get individuals on the same platform and give them the same resource tool bag, we're in a sad state, folks. And Kansas City is a perfect example of that. We, Kansas City is a great place to raise a family until they get to age five and have to think about kindergarten. And then we are in an even worse situation that across the state line is the only thing that invests in its public education system. And so we don't deal with suburban sprawl or white flight or any of those things in a manner like most cities, because they not only do they leave the urban core, they leave our state tax base. They cross into a whole nother state. And so it's even more of a dilemma that we need to be so much more proactive with how we invest in our social infrastructure than reactive.
We're getting some reaction from this live conversation on Facebook here. Beckett Graham says, if the school system isn't fixed, the city will die. Rebecca Glenn replies, in summary, as a transplant from D.C., I couldn't agree more. I think that's been established here in this discussion. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are talking about city building one block at a time and why urban renewal neighborhood by neighborhood works. Our guests are Tim Dugan. He's a senior landscape architect for the Make It Right Foundation. You might be familiar with Brad Pitt's work down there in New Orleans. Mr. Dugan works both in New Orleans and in projects here in KC. And Simon O'Byrne is the vice president of urban planning from Stantec and from a magical kingdom called Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. He's here learning a lot of stuff about the New American City. This is the New American City Conference. We're live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, the first of a two-part series here on Central Standard about the New American City and a lot of issues facing the urban legends and myths and realities of the future. Talk about some of the number one action items that came out of this breakout session, city building one block at a time. What were the salient points that came out of this discussion?
Well, I think a few just very quick statements rang very loud and clear is that innovation leads to replication, and we need to set a framework that encourages innovation in a pragmatic and sustainable way. Sustainable development for our cities is a very interesting conversation. You can look at the green environmentalists on one hand, and you can look at the bean counters on the other, and they will never be, they will always be in conflict. But until you show, until you show the bean counter the value in hugging trees, until you show the economic sustainability of these decisions, then you're going to beat your head on a wall for a long time. And only when you create a new metric and a new process to find that information is when you'll build a sustainable development. And as our cities are at a crossroads, we need to implore everybody to look to a regenerative model, to look to the next 50 years, to look towards innovation and replication, and build a platform for development that way, because it's not going to be how we did it for the last 50 years.
Simon O'Byrne, you've been out and about in KC. What is your assessment of the city in terms of its history and planning and what you've been hearing literally and figuratively on the ground? You've had some recent conversations with our mayor, Sylvester Sly James, about the city and urban planning and development. What do you see here in Kansas City?
I had a great conversation with him yesterday and learned a lot about the history, and I had a chance last night to go to Country Club Plaza, and an architect who had lived in that district for 10 years walked me around and talked about the history of it and Civil War battles happening at the creek and the whole concept of the bowl in terms of the planning and the history of it, everything from, you know, the Hallmark family or Hall family doing the unique department store. And so it was fascinating. There's a lot of Kansas City is this fascinating, exciting place because you have the state line right there, because you have what's going on. There's so many layers of history, and so I feel that so much. It's both from an outsider, it's very fascinating. From a local person, it must be pulling your hair out, just screaming mad, because there's so much baggage of history that's very present in everyday decisions in Kansas City about where we live, where we work, where we invest, what's going on. And so one of the things that's been really become aware to me is the history that it's There's literally baggage from the Civil War that's still present here in Kansas City today, you know, hearing people about how things are laid out and what happened in the history. And then, of course, there's issues of poverty, there's issues of race, there's issues that that all intersect here. And so from an outsider, it's fascinating. From a local, it must be kind of frustrating. One of the I'm just going to digress for a quick second on something related to yesterday's session, because I wanted to capture an idea that was brought up by Mayor Kwan, who's the mayor of Oakland yesterday, and she talked about, and I talked about as well. One of the big things that's going to be driving population growth going forward is immigration. If it were not for immigration, sometime in the 2030s or 40s, most of North America, both Canada and the United States, are going to be declining in population. In fact, by sometime in the 2030s, even in Kansas City, one in four people in this region is going to be senior citizens. So that means planning for a society with reduced mobility, because a quarter are going to be seniors. But the big thing is, because of this aging population, we're going to need immigrants. Where are the immigrants coming from right now in North America? Overwhelmingly, they're coming from places in the world where they're used to living together, multi-generational housing. What's very slow to happen in Kansas City and most places is to recognize that who's driving population growth is immigrants that desire multi-generational housing. So we're not building in Johnson County or in the suburbs, we're not building, you know, if you were to go to like areas that do have multi-generational families living together, you'll find two kitchens, a spice kitchen, a regular kitchen, and maybe 8 or 10 bedrooms. You might even find 12 people on a mortgage together. Even if they're low to moderate income, they're pooling their money to buy homes together. But this is when we're talking about urban renewal, we're not adapting that to the urban environment. So an urban environment means if we're putting new condos in, like, you know, there are some in within the Plaza area, there might be 3 or 4 bedrooms, but they're probably the penthouse suites and the sub-penthouse suites. Well, who can afford that? What we need to be doing is building more 3, 4, and even 5 bedroom suites, but on the second and third level where they're going to be affordable. And that's how we're going to cater to this new population that's driving growth within our regions in North America, is providing multi-generational housing that's affordable for them in urban areas and not pushing them out to the suburbs. Because if they want to cohabitate and live together, and if you go to, whether it's people from Mexico, people from the Philippines, people from Iran, people from Eastern Europe. It's just the norm. Most of the world's population, with the exception of parts of Western Europe and North America, live together in a multi-generational environment. So we need to start building housing that caters to who's driving our new population growth.
Bringing it back to the now and bringing it back local, Tim Dugan, you are on the ground in Kansas City. Our other guest, Simon, was talking about, from an outsider, it's very fascinating to witness the legacy of the Civil War and the legacy of Jim Crow and segregation still reverberating, still permeating throughout the city in subtle and obvious ways. What's it like watching that on the ground as a developer of neighborhoods?
Well, I think we're actually at a very interesting opportunity in Kansas City. We have, yes, we have to replace our infrastructure. Yes, we have a $4 billion water dilemma in front of us. Yes, we do need to restore our school districts. But I think that's also an opportunity. Our city was founded around a parks and boulevard system that is one of the most interconnected natural systems-based planning processes that have been replicated across this country. That's a perfect opportunity to rebuild and restore. So utilizing our infrastructure abilities with one of our most thriving amenities in this city is parks and boulevards. We have the tools to fix our school district, and we just need to figure out how to bring all those players together for the first time and not look to the past, but look to the future. And there are movements taking place. We're seeing firsthand a thriving downtown. I mean, 10 years ago, downtown was not in the situation that it is today, for good, bad, or indifferent. We are seeing a renaissance in Kansas City that's, from somebody local, is very inspirational. And it also empowers the day-to-day activities to be a part of that rebuilding effort. And I just invite and encourage others to get more involved in this renaissance and not use perceptions and history as a tool for blame, but use it as a crutch for support and build upon that.
Talk about dynamism, though. Carl Schramm, when he left the Kauffman Foundation, called Kansas City the least dynamic city in America. Pretty harsh, but from his opinion, that's his opinion. How do you keep the Renaissance going? How do you create a dynamic, continual effect?
Well, the show me state. We live in a culture that makes you kick the tires before you drive the car, and so. We're doing that firsthand, and it goes back to the initial statement that started this interview. We're starting a renaissance on one block, on one school, on just a little neighborhood called Mannheim Park, east of Troost, that has the richest social fabric in this city, but it needs some support to galvanize its neighborhood fabric and make it sustainable. And so I think each of these projects, whether it's the arena or the Kauffman Foundation or the Downtown Renaissance or even Bancroft School over in Green Impact Zone, one project at a time is going to build some momentum because we have amazing neighborhood stock. I mean, when you go drive down Benton Boulevard and you drive down some of these other
beautiful houses there,
beautiful, yeah, beautiful building stocks. And we just need to elevate the education and reduce the perception and deal with some of the crime issues. And I think we're doing that. It's just the issue is scale and how fast can you deal with scale. And that's what we're dealing with.
Based on your assessment and your visit here, Simon O'Byrne, what's a brief prescription for Kansas City? He talked about scale. Build on that.
There's so much potential. I'm jealous. I wish the architecture in Edmonton was as good as it is in Kansas City. There's such a beautiful wealth of gorgeous historical buildings and new ones like the one we're in right now. Kansas City is rich in architectural history. I think about the opportunity, and right now it's just not even coming close to living up to its potential opportunity, and there's a big gulf in between. I think of it in terms of the downtown and the urban areas. It's like having a full-time employee. It's like having a full-time employee. You're paying them a full-time salary, but they're only working part-time hours. They're only working 4 or 5 hours a week, but you're paying them 40 hours a week. The government and everyone's paid for the soft and hard infrastructure, whether that's police, libraries, whether that's hard infrastructure like sewers, but there's this big gulf. We need to go from the 5 hours a week to the 40 hours a week that we're paying for, and there's such opportunity here that's so rich and special. And I think Kansas City, if you could, you talk about it as an ego, but you could also talk about it as an opportunity. It's fantastic.
We thank our guest, Simon O'Byrne and Tim Dugan. Simon O'Byrne is Vice President of Urban Planning for Stantec, and Tim Dugan is a Senior Landscape Architect for the Make It Right Foundation. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can go to kcur.org for archives and podcasts of today's program and other programs of Central Standard. This is the first in a series. Matthew Long Middleton is our producer. Bill Anderson is our executive producer, with special thanks from Steven Steigman and Chris Pruitt and Kim Noble back at KCUR Studios. We now hand it off to UpToDate, which will examine other breakout sessions in this ongoing coverage of the discussion of what new American cities will look like, be like, feel like. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Enjoy your day. Ain't no love in the heart of time.